We don't quite have a quorum yet, but I'm going to have Representative Hoppe start, and then once we get a quorum, I'll officially call the meeting to order. Just one short. So why don't you go ahead, Representative Hoppe?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. We are here talking about House File 371, and I appreciate being in front of the committee this morning. Also, one of the things that I'm going to ask, and I don't know if we did this officially, maybe Mr. Koch knows this, but I'd like to have this bill referred to Commerce. It's still, as we say, a work in progress. And what I'd like to do is, Mr. Shepard sent me some changes that I didn't get in time to put into an amendment. I think there are changes that make sense that clean up the bill. And then we will make those changes. And we also have some bigger work to do in terms of agreements with public safety and some other things that we'd like to iron out. So if we can send it to Commerce, we'll make those changes. And then if you or the committee wants to see it back, we can certainly send it back here. House File 371 is a bill that we're looking at. It involves the PEEP program, and we're looking at who is getting into PEEP and what it is and what it has been, what it was designed for, and what it seems to be becoming. And the bill, as it's written and as it's introduced, I think addresses a lot of those concerns and not all of the ones I had. And we can go through the bill step by step, and I can get Mr. Walseth down here if we want to do that, or if members have questions, do we want to do more explanation of the bill? What would you like us to do, Madam Chair?
I think why don't you just continue explaining the bill, have your folks down and explain, and I'm still waiting for one more member.
Okay. I'll have Mr. Walseth start the explanation, and we'll be happy to answer any questions at any time or however you want to do it.
Madam Chair, members, Sam Walseth with the Service Cooperatives. We've been a part of a group of local governments and purchasers who are interested in this legislation. There are some issues with how groups are going into PEEP, particularly in small jurisdictions with employee groups. You might have a group of teachers going into PEEP, but leaving janitors or support staff back, and we'd like some clarification from the legislature about if that's a best practice or not. We think, especially in those smaller communities, that the employees should get together and decide whether or not they all want to go into that program or not. There was an instance in the Painesville School District where approximately about 120 teachers and paraprofessionals were together as a group, but about 90 teachers went into PEEP, leaving 30 paraprofessionals behind. And there's some confusion about whether or not you need to treat the remaining 30 paraprofessionals as what we call a reform group, a group of less than 50, or if they're technically still a group of 120. And it's just leading to some confusion and some administrative complications when you start chopping up the employee groups in those political subdivisions. So we'd like some clarification there. And then I think, health insurance benefits are traditionally, they're bargain benefits. State law does not allow a city, county, or school district management to make any kind of unilateral change to aggregate value of benefits. That even includes changing provider networks. And so we think the management or governance of a local city, county, or school district should be involved in that decision-making process to at least be able to review the bids that employee groups are getting from PEEP to see what impact that might have on the remaining employee groups. It may look good for one employee group to go in, but you end up creating some adverse selection for the rest of them. And the local management, who has the fiduciary responsibility for those local budgets, should be at the table and be involved in those decisions, as current law really does require them to be. And then there's another section, the remaining part of Section 1 of the bill are some consumer protection statutes that I like to refer to as the Davney Amendment. Representative Davney and I worked together several years ago, and those requirements about requiring that the purchaser or the program, say the service cooperatives in the current law under 123A.21, their statute, whereby they must give claims data to the group upon request, and they cannot penalize a group for comparison shopping. And we think that those are good protections for groups. They were rightfully added to the service cooperative statutes, and we'd like to see them also added to the PEEP statutes just to level the playing field for the two groups that are kind of competing right now. So, and there are a couple other, there's another provision there in Section 2. I'm not an expert on that. I think some of the folks from the cities might have some information on that, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you. We do have a quorum now, so I will call the meeting officially to order. Representative Hornstein, did you get a chance to review the minutes?
Let me make sure that I read those.
All right.
I would move approval of the minutes.
Representative Hornstein moves approval of Tuesday, March 15 minutes. Changes or corrections? Seeing none, all those in favor of approval of the minutes, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Minutes are approved. Representative Beard, would you like to move Representative Hoppe's bill?
Madam Chair, I'll move House File 3071. Move it's recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Commerce Committee.
Okay. Representative Beard moves that House File 371 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Commerce Committee. We can go back to, would you like to have, do we need anybody else to present, or would you like to take questions?
Madam Chair, I think we have other people that would like to speak on the bill, and I'll get
okay.
away and let them do it.
Welcome to the committee.
Welcome, Madam Chair. My name is Kirk Schneider, and on staff at the Minnesota School Boards Association. And we thank Representative Hoppe for bringing this issue forward. We urge the support for the reforms in 371. School boards are responsible for making sure school district budgets are balanced and benefit costs are in line with state and local financial support for educational services. To protect employee interests in salary and benefits, state law outlines a collective bargaining process by which decisions about compensation are reached. State law does not allow boards to make unilateral changes in the aggregate value of insurance benefits, including even a simple change in provider network. That is why we're concerned about the current law that allows employee groups to make a unilateral decision to move into the PEEP program. Historically, PEEP has been an insurer of last resort, and an enrollment in the program hasn't been on the radar screen. However, we've been made aware that nearly two-thirds of the school employee groups in Minnesota are currently seeking bids in PEEP. PEEP may be able to provide better coverage at a better price for employees at public schools. But at this time, the people paying the bills, such as school districts, and who are responsible for balancing the budget are not aware of these bids at all. We don't know which employee groups in these districts are considering moving into PEEP and whether or not that includes all insurance-eligible employees. This is why we're supporting the reforms in 371. For starters, the legislation requires the employee groups in a particular school district to get on the same page and decide by majority vote in all of the employee groups or none desire to move into PEEP. This will prevent problems caused by current law whereby teacher groups may leave a district health plan and leave the support staff behind, as Mr. Walseth shared. The legislation also requires the exclusive rep and the eligible employer to review the insurance bids from PEEP and compare them to the current health coverage offerings. Keep in mind that two-thirds of school employee groups, not school districts, school employee groups currently or seeking bids aren't required to even share that information with school boards that they are gathering. More importantly, when it comes to PEEP enrollment, the eligible employer who is paying the bill and who has fiduciary responsibility for the district's finances must approve the decision to enroll into PEEP. And the last provision of the section of the bill extends consumer protections and the best practice competitive bidding requirements to PEEP. And so I will be available for questions if you have it.
Representative Hoppe, did you have anyone else testifying in favor of the bill?
Madam Chair, I think there are a couple of more people that want to come down and speak on the bill.
Okay. Welcome to the committee, and if you could please just state your name and who you're with before you start.
Madam Chair, members, I'm Keith Carlson. I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Intercounty Association. And I'll start first, and then my colleague from League of Minnesota Cities will testify. On behalf of the 13 counties that are members of my organization, we are here in support of this bill. You've heard considerable information about Section 1, and I want to indicate we do support it. We're very concerned about the effects of the unilateral ability of any one bargaining unit to elect into PEEP, basically leaving the rest of our employees stranded within our existing health plans at possibly higher rates. The adverse selection that can occur under this type of situation is something that we definitely want to avoid, and the additional administrative burdens that are placed by having to administer multiple health plans is also something that our human resources directors very much want to avoid. I'm going to direct most of my comments to the remainder of the bill that speaks to what is the provisions of current law that requires us as local government employers to allow our retirees to participate in our group insurance plans. This creates, under current accounting standards, referred to as GASB 45, what is called an implicit rate subsidy. Basically, obviously, older individuals have higher health care costs, but because of the provision of current law that requires those under age 65 to be pooled with our active employees and in effect get the same premiums as our active employees, there's what's called a subsidy, or in the terminology of the accounting standard, an implicit rate subsidy, where the active younger employees and the employer are subsidizing the retirees. We're supposed to acknowledge that on our financial statements and come up with a plan to amortize that cost over the expected life of these so-called benefits. The document that I've passed out was prepared by the Legislative Auditor's Office when they did a study on post-employment benefits, which is basically health care for retirees. And they identified for school districts alone had the implicit subsidy costing them over $1 billion a year. More recent study done by the Office of the State Auditor, where about 270 of the 300-plus districts responded, identified that cost for the responding districts at about $500 million a year. So I want to make it clear that more current information has its less, but obviously it's still substantial. What this bill does is basically say, retirees, you can still participate in the group insurance program that you participated in when you were employed, but you will pay your full freight. You will pay the full cost of providing health insurance to you at a rate that's appropriate for your age and your health. They'll still be allowed to participate, but there will no longer be the subsidy. So if you enact this bill as proposed here, that $500 million subsidy that school districts has for this implicit rate subsidy would disappear off their books. And I would say I do not have the similar figure for counties and cities, but I'm sure it's in the same neighborhood that we're providing this subsidy to the tune of over $500 million annually, above and beyond what the school districts do. With that, I'll conclude and be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Madam Chair and members, my name is Erin Ryan. I am a human resource manager with the League of Minnesota Cities. The League of Minnesota Cities supports the reforms outlined in House File 371. Others have testified in support of this bill and articulated their concerns with respect to employee groups being able to unilaterally move into the public employee insurance program. This has been a concern as well for some cities, and we concur with the issues that have already been expressed by others supporting the bill. Cities as employers should have a voice in determining what coverage they will offer to employees. If you look at it from the flip side, a city could not unilaterally decide to move an employee group to a different benefit plan or to a different insurance carrier without negotiating the changes in the aggregate value of benefits. What House File 371 does, in our opinion, is level the playing field for all parties at the table. In addition, we support the changes to the mandate that require public employers pool their early retirees with active employees. This pooling requirement creates additional financial liabilities for cities and increased reporting requirements, as Mr. Carlson has indicated to you, that can be pretty costly to cities and other organizations. We do have some technical concerns about the proposed language, but we are confident that we can work with the authors of the bill and other proponents to come to some mutually agreeable language. And in closing, I would encourage your support of House File 371, and I would be available for questions. Thank you.
Okay, we do have a few folks that want to testify, more folks. Is there anybody have a question for any of the witnesses we've already had so far? Okay, we will move on then, if that's all right with you, Representative Hoppe, to continue. Paul Olson. Good morning. Welcome to the committee. If you could just please state your name and who you're with for the record.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair. I'm Paul Olson. I'm a teacher in Moose Lake, Minnesota. And my purpose for being here is really to share with you the impact that PEEP has had on us as a staff and our coverage and our premium. Just a little background. 2 years ago, we opted into a pool or to a study in, to get into the pool with PEEP. We were in the service cooperative, and our rates had been consistently going up. And we were not actually pooled in the sense that PEEP pools us. So each individual district was being adjusted as our own Moose Lake could possibly see a... we've seen increases of 15-20%. The neighboring district saw flat decreases or increases only of, say, single digits. And this was, we were all part of the same group. So we saw a lot of inconsistency throughout. Our intent was to get into a pool where we were all together. And as it turned out, 14 schools entered into this pool. And it's roughly around 5,000 employees or lives. What has happened is in our first year, we paid slightly more on the premiums than we were paying with the EXU. But in the second year, we saw an increase of only 6%, where we know that the EXU pool had gone up more than that. The service cooperative. This year... Moose Lake School District, the pool in general saw a 6.6% decrease, and Moose Lake School actually saw a 23% decrease in the cost of our premiums. That's pretty significant. It's interesting because we heard a little testimony about the leaving of other support staff behind. We met with our support staff many times over the initial looking at this pool, and they opted not to join us. And as a result, the plan that they were under had been eliminated, and the plan that they have now with the service cooperative is actually more expensive than the plan that we have with PEEP. So it actually costs the district... they pay the same amount, I guess. They pay a dollar amount to us. But I guess at this, we would not have seen this realization of this savings of this kind, I think, if we didn't take this opportunity. And we have to, I think we're going to see these things continue. And I'm very excited about the fact that we've managed to level this out for us. So I don't know. I don't have anything else to say. Lee, you might have something.
I'm Lee Stevenson. I'm
Hello.
A teacher in Moose Lake as well, and we've been sort of handling insurance issues for our staff, and I wanted to reiterate part of what Paul said, because it seems to go contrary to the testimony we've heard thus far, which is that we could somehow unilaterally leave and the support staff is somehow left hanging. Our support staff chose not to follow us to PEEP, and so maybe there are some different dynamics between local governments, city governments, and school districts. I'm not sure how all of that plays out, but just to be clear, our support staff chose to not join the teachers when we moved to PEEP. And there was just one thing I'd like to address from the actual language of the bill. The language that says the eligible employer approves the decision to opt into the program. That would mean at a school district that if the staff voted to leave a service co-op to join PEEP, that the superintendent could override that vote of the employees. And I don't know what really incentive there is for the superintendents of various school districts to go along with what their employees would have voted for. Our example in Moose Lake is that our superintendent was on the board of the service co-op. So he had certain incentives to keep us with the service co-op. When we were seeking a bid from PEEP, that essentially brought competition into a market where there was no competition. The service co-op, when they knew that we were seeking a bid from PEEP, they brought forth their first ever decreases in rates. We had not seen decreases in rates until they knew that there was a chance that they could lose us. But if it is up to the superintendent as to if we can join PEEP or not, that takes away some real true market dynamics that are created when PEEP essentially is a competition to the service co-ops. And the number of in excess of 200 school districts now are seeking PEEP bids. When we joined PEEP, there were 77 districts that were seeking PEEP bids, and yet only 14 schools chose to join the PEEP pool. So that, like I said, that market dynamic of seeking some competition caused the co-ops to offer comparable rates or lower rates from the previous year. And so I think that if you look at it in that way, that by allowing the staff to choose for themselves, that it creates a level of competition that otherwise doesn't exist. So I guess that's at this point, if you had questions for a couple of school teachers who have lived through this mm-hmm. process of moving to PEEP, we'd be happy to address some questions.
Okay. Representative Murray.
Madam Chairwoman, I would like to ask either one of the testifiers if I would think the school board's looking at this from a financial standpoint, and they're going to look at the benefits, and if they're like benefits from one plan to the next plan, that they would allow a PEEP plan or any other kind of plan to come on board. Why would you not want them to be part of that process, or why shouldn't they be part of that approval process to change plans?
Mr. Stephenson?
It's not that I wouldn't want them to be a part of it, but I wouldn't want them to have veto power over the decision of the staff. Of the employees, and the language of the bill seems to allow for a school superintendent to veto the decision of the staff. And you could correct me if I'm wrong on that language, but the example that I gave, I think, would be a very real one for many school districts where the cooperative boards are made up of board members, school board members and superintendents. Do they then have a vested interest or an incentive in keeping the school with the co-op? Because it's not going to be a financial difference for the school district. Mm-hmm. Our school district pays a flat rate toward our insurance, regardless of if we are with PEEP or with the co-op. The difference, though, the savings is felt by the teachers or the the insured.
Representative Murray.
Madam Chair, I still question, though, why you should have that authority to put yourselves into that plan, but the school board shouldn't be on board with it when they're in charge of the finances of the school. It just seems to make sense to me that a school board, if they're looking at their true fiduciary duties and looking at financial things, they're going to look at, we need to have a comparative plan for what you're using or what you have now. I mean, they couldn't unilaterally just take you out of the plan you're in and put you in a subpar plan because they could save money on their own. So I don't know why they can't be at the table here and be involved. I would hope that if they're part of the cooperative, they're still not going to use that as, well, I'm sorry, we can't
well, I
do
think
this.
Mr. Olson? I can just respond to this one issue, and that is that, you know, when we initially got into this, we were actually, I can speak to my own experience, the premium that I was paying, as you know, for my family, was roughly $120 more than what the service cooperative plan of Equal Plan was in. But right now, the premium itself is actually lower through PEEP than the service cooperative plan's premium is, in essence, saving the district money. That took 2 years to see that. And I'm afraid that all too often things are very short-sighted. And I'm afraid that they would look at an alternative like this and say that it was going to cost the district more. 2 years later, we'd be saving that money.
Representative Murray.
I'm all for the competition. That's mm-hmm. not where I'm going with this. What I'm going for is all parties need to be at the table here and be able to say yay or nay to this thing. I'm glad you saved money on it. I'm glad you got a better plan or the same plan or whatever. That's what you should be doing, though, together with the school board. That shouldn't be just unilaterally your decision to make. That should be a joint effort between both parties, and they should both be at the table to do this. They should be going out just as part of everyday doing business, getting quotes from time to time, and looking at competition to bring you a better plan. And if it's going to save them money, I don't know why they wouldn't be doing that. So I don't want to, you know, question. A number of insurance companies in the last year have actually cut some rates, so we've seen that across the board with a number of them. So it may have just been timing that happened. And yes, when you brought PEEP to the table, the other company came back and they're going to try to save that business. No doubt about that. So I'm not questioning the coverage or the savings or anything else. I'm questioning both parties should be at the table to make that decision.
And I would,
Wilson.
Oh, I'm sorry. I would not disagree that they shouldn't be there, but if. And I guess that's a point of clarification, because the way that we understand this, it would be left to the, and in our case, the superintendent to make that final decision. We could discuss it, but if the superintendent did not want to go there, they could have that final say in light of any facts. And in a small district, that's pretty easy to make.
Just one quick point.
Representative Murray.
And that's fine. Madam Chair. I just would think that the six school board members sitting there would have a talk with that superintendent if he was deciding to keep you in something that was going to cost your district another $100,000 or $200,000. And so I would hope that they would be on board with, you know, making sure that we were doing the right thing for the taxpayers and the people of the school district. Thank you.
If I could make one final comment,
yes,
to
Stephenson.
Address your concern, would it be a collaborative effort? Both sides at the table making a joint decision if, in fact, as the language reads, the eligible employer approves the decision. I mean, that isn't collaborative. That would be a singular vote on the part of the administrator, in our case the superintendent. This is on line 1.24. It doesn't read to me as to be that sort of collaborative goal that you're addressing.
Representative Nelson.
I'll pass for now.
Okay, we do have several other folks that want to testify. Do we have any question for these witnesses in particular? Thank you very much. Next on the list is Jim Granger. And then Jan Elschweiger. Well, first, before we go forward, We have here the 11th and 12th grade students from St. Anthony Village High School. They're participating in the Minnesota Historical Society Capital Historic Sites Voice of the People, Your Role in Minnesota Government Tour and Educational Program. Welcome to the committee. I'll give them a round of applause. Yeah. This is the first time we haven't had St. Louis Park here in days. So, anyways, welcome. Hope you pick something interesting up from the committee. Okay, Mr. Granger, would you like to start?
My name is Jim Granger. I work for Education Minnesota. I would like to start by saying I taught for over 30 years before I joined the staff at Education Minnesota. During that 30 years of teaching, I was very actively involved in the health insurance in my district, Detroit Lakes, and in my region as I was on the Lakes Country Service Co-op Insurance Advisory Board. During that time, I watched a service co-op search for ways to keep the price of health insurance down. Their solution almost always ended at an increasing co-pays, deductibles, reducing benefits, or increasing premiums. That's the traditional method for trying to deal with the rising cost of health care. They saw no other way, and the cost of health insurance premiums rose at rates that were and are unsustainable. During the majority of these years, the employees of public schools were essentially held hostage by the service co-ops, had enacted a policy kicking a district out if the if the pool sought a bid from a different vendor, and now we know, of course, that has changed. It was when the legislation passed that the bill allowed bargaining units to seek their own bids that we had a chance to enter the competitive market. As the prior two testifiers said, what has happened is with the service co-ops is that traditionally those boards are made up of administrators from the districts. And while I sat on an insurance advisory committee with teachers on it, the actual board that made the decisions was made up of all administrators. And so as those administrators had a vested interest in staying as much as they could with those co-ops, Alexandria was the first to go. They requested a bid from and found it to their liking. They requested the rest of the district to join, but the administration declined. I believe the Alexandria administration declined partially because their business manager served on the Lakes Country Service Advisory Committee and on the insurance committee. Over the next years, Alexandria teachers enjoyed a smaller increase in premiums cost than did the rest of the Alexandria employees. Detroit Lakes is a similar story. The business manager for Detroit Lakes serves on the Insurance Advisory Committee for Lakes Country Service Co-op also. When I went to talk to him about looking at PEEP, he wasn't interested, nor was the superintendent. We proceeded with the process of educating the staff on how PEEP worked. We talked with all of the other bargaining units and offered them as much interest or as information as we could. They made an informed decision to go with PEEP, even though it would cost each person about $20 a month more in premium. The teachers did this because they saw that the PEEP model of managed competition shifted the emphasis to primary care clinics competing for the primary care clinics competing for the business would keep the cost down without shifting the cost to me. It worked. The first premium renewal, Detroit Lakes teachers saw an increase of 8.75%. The rest of the district's employees who were with the service Lake Country Service Co-op at the time had an 11.4% increase. This year, the 2009 pool saw an average decrease of 6.6%, with Detroit Lakes teachers seeing a 2% decrease. The plan works. Look at the history of the State Advantage Plan. Over the last 6 years, the average increase for the state employees has been just about 3.5%. For 6 years, that's the average. I believe history, frustration, and other factors have caused school administrations to ignore the potential that PEEP has to save employees money. I have spent many hours explaining the law that allows bargaining units to seek bids to school employees and to administrators. The scenario played out time and again. The employees were interested, and the administrators, for the most part, were not. I can only explain the administrators' disinterest as defeatist or condescending. I contend that if the employees in the 14 school districts who formed a health care pool hadn't decided to exercise their opportunities under the law, they would be paying a lot more in health care premiums. They would be just another part of the problem instead of actively looking for solutions. House File 371 will take away the opportunity for school employees to act on their own to explore saving money for themselves, the school district, and ultimately the state. If school district administrators won't act, school employees should be allowed to do so on their own. Please defeat this bill.
Okay, we have a question. Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess what I want to understand is, and maybe this has been discussed, I don't think so. So, through the collective bargaining process, I assume the contributions of the employer to health benefits are determined.
Correct.
And is there anything in the bargaining unit making its own decision that would increase the cost of benefits back to the school district?
Mr. Granger?
Mr. Chair? No, there isn't, because within the collective bargaining agreement, in most cases, and I can't speak for 400 some contracts, but I know from experience that typically the amount of contribution by the district is set. And if there's any, and if the premium costs more than that, then it is contributed by the employees.
Mr. Chair, I guess I want to make sure. So step one, collective bargaining process, dollar contribution is set towards health insurance premiums. Step two, employees decide how they want to use that contribution to purchase health insurance, whether through PEEP, whether through any other opportunity in the market. Is that how it works?
Correct.
And I guess the final point is, you know, over time health insurance premiums may go up or may go down. I suppose school districts or cities could argue that if they don't have a seat at the table, then the employees will continue to pick plans that are unnecessarily expensive, and as a result they'll start bargaining for higher contributions from the employer. But it seems to me that in order to do that, they would have to be paying a lot higher premiums themselves in order to get that. Isn't that right?
Mr. Granger.
Madam Chair, in essence, I believe you're correct, because we already have, in essence, skin in the game, and so the amount that, while we may go to the table and ask for more money contribution-wise from the school district, that I don't see that happening too much right now, given the current state of financial affairs for the state. We have a vested interest in keeping that cost down, because we share the cost. Anything that this school district contributes is from the school district. The rest comes from us, and so the more that we can save money, the more we save money.
So
Representative Winkler.
So finally, Madam Chair, Mr. Granger, I guess the final point would be maybe a private sector equivalent would be that your employer says, here's your salary, here's the benefit package, we'll contribute, you know, $300 a month towards a health insurance premium, and you can either use one that we find for you, or you can go find one for yourself. Would that kind of be the, you know, simple employment terms?
Mr. Granger.
In essence, yeah, I think that would be a way to simplify it.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Murray.
As a small business person that actually has a health plan for their employees, I would have a real problem with my employees coming to me and say, Mr. Murray, here's the new health plan that we're going to implement for your company next week. I want to be at that table talking to them about it. I would like to ask the same question of the testifiers here that I asked the last two. If the school board should be interested in providing the best possible benefits at the best possible cost, why don't you want them at the table helping in this decision?
Mr. Granger.
Madam Chair, I wouldn't say it's that we didn't want them at the table, because in every case, in every district that I helped, including my own district at the time, we went to the administration and said, we'd like you to be part of this. We'd like you to listen to what we have to say. And in all cases, they said, we are not interested. I don't know how much more I can, what else I can say is that in literally in all cases, we asked them, would you listen to what we have to say? This is interesting. This has potential. And they all said, we're not interested.
Ms. Alschweiger, would you like to go now?
Madam Chair, excuse me, members of the committee, Jan Alschweiger, Education Minnesota. Yes, I would love to talk about this issue. Let's go back, because you need to understand, I believe, why this bill is before us. Education Minnesota tried to pass a statewide health insurance pool that was mandatory for school employees. And what did legislators tell us? Vetoed three times. Legislators said we want it voluntary, we want competition. In fact, everyone who just testified said we want it voluntary and we want more competition. So guess what we did? We thought out of the box. We decided to go for a voluntary plan that had more competition. Yes, two-thirds of the districts are going out for bids because they cannot afford insurance. Six districts no longer have health insurance. Having increases of 23% or 20% or 50%, we see that. In fact, one of the districts that went into PEEP had a $33,000 family premium. Another one had $28,000 family premium. And in every one of these cases, they're saying, the school board is saying no. Why don't they want competition? Why don't they want this voluntary plan for our members? All Education Minnesota is trying to do is have the ability for teachers and school employees to have health care that is affordable. The question is asked over and over again, and I think you're asking a very, very good question. Why shouldn't the school boards help make this decision? I'll tell you what the problem is. There is a huge conflict of interest. By law, there is a requirement that the majority of the service co-op board be school board members. And then there's superintendents. And yes, you might have an occasional teacher on the board, or maybe a teacher on every board. You will not get a real clean, transparent, equal decision on this until you get rid of the conflict of interest. I would ask the service co-ops and the school boards, how does your district benefit from school service co-ops? Are they paying for your spelling bees, your knowledge bowls, the legislative dinner that is held, or the legislative update that is held after the session? Are they paid for with our members' health insurance money? Ask them. Can you tell us for sure that all the money that our members pay into, that the teachers and the school employees pay to the service co-ops for health insurance benefits is paid for only the insurance product and the administration of the product? Or is some of our members' health insurance premiums used for spelling bee, knowledge bowl? I have lots of stories I could tell you, but this really isn't a conflict of interest hearing, and if we want to have that hearing, we could do that. There's issues about rebating back to districts, and I'm not going to start throwing that stuff around, but we can. You can't get a clear decision if there's a big conflict of interest. The second part of the bill that requires the retirees to be pulled out of the pool is a problem in that, yes, I understand that it creates a bigger financial burden for the school districts. If they are not in the pool, you have to ask yourself, where are they going to get their insurance? My guess is it's going to become a burden on the state because they're not going to be able to afford some of the insurance. Education Minnesota thinks that they should all be part of the pool because it helps level it out. We would ask that we try to find a solution, because when you hear these figures, a 23% decrease in the 14 districts that are already in, 23% decrease in Moose Lake, 2% decrease in Detroit Lakes. And in Duluth, over 3 years, there is a savings of $9 million. $9 million. Now, Representative Winkler is exactly right. This isn't just like a straight-out savings to the district. And in any situation, it isn't a straight-out increase in cost. Because the school district in the union negotiates a certain dollar amount or percentage, but almost in every case it's a dollar amount, to contribute towards the health insurance. So if they have a big savings, it really doesn't have an impact on the district. It has an impact on the employee. But one could argue that it could have an impact on future negotiations and future costs for health for the health insurance for the school district. On July 1st in Duluth, they will see an 8% drop in their insurance premiums, $1.7 million. This provides a voluntary opportunity. It provides for competition. And if there are issues about the school board being included, because we understand, Representative Murray, what you're trying to get to, we really do need to deal with the issue of the conflict of interest. If we could be sure that all school boards were engaged and there was a fair chance, maybe it would possibly work. But the current situation, as Mr. Granger indicated, is not working. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Before we do that, there are some very, very strong accusations made, and I would like to give the School Boards Association an opportunity to respond to those before we take questions. Ms. Schwab, would you like to talk?
Madam Chairman and members, thank you for this opportunity to at least respond to some of the accusations that were brought by Education Minnesota against school board members from around the state. She did a lot of light tap dancing around the issue. Members, when you become a school board member, you are required to take an oath of office, similar to what you take when you pick up your legislative positions. That brings with it a responsibility to manage the district in the best possible way. The bill we're talking about today, in its present form, without any of the changes in front of you, allows one employee group to decide on their own to move to PEEP without consulting the school board, without necessarily even talking to any of the other units. That can leave a very uninsurable group that the district has to figure out how to make it go forward. And oftentimes, the quality of health care teachers receive really matters to school boards, because in the end, the longer we can keep that teacher in the classroom with kids, the better our kids do. Mm-hmm. So we want a healthy teacher. We want a quality health plan that works, and we're trying to do the best we can. If, in fact, the truth were really known, I would say employees arbitrarily deciding on their own where to go is a conflict of interest also. Thank you, Madam Chairman. I appreciate the opportunity to share our thoughts and rebut some of the accusations that were made in this hearing.
Representative Beard, I have several on the list here. We do have, just to let everyone know, a little time table here. We do have a few more people that want to testify, but since we have some interesting discussion now, I think I'll take a break and take questions to either Ms. Kelleher or Ms. Elschweiger. Representative Beard?
Well, my questions, Madam Chair, were aimed at Ms. Elschweiger and Mr. Granger, and I think the previous testifiers, because there were some pretty dark aspersions cast on administrators, that somehow they have and I'm glad Ms. Elschweiger brought out the conflict of interest statement, because I was going to go there with my questions. The inference was that somehow these people have some sort of a conflict in being obtuse, non-cooperative, because of their position on a service co-op board. Now, I've never served on the Education Committee. but I've been around a little bit, enough to know that we put together these service co-ops or authority for the, districts to have them as a method of economizing on purchases like for equipment and supplies and things that make our school districts run more efficiently, more effectively. Apparently somewhere along the way, the ability to use the co-ops to purchase, to expand the pool and buy better health insurance coverage for a lower price came along. But these people that serve on the boards of these co-ops, do they get paid for that, or do they get some sort of a bonus for creating a larger surplus at the end of the year?
Ms. Alschweiger?
Madam Chair and Representative Beard, I don't have that information.
Mr. Granger, do you have that information?
I think I can, Madam Chair, I can share a little bit. As a service co-ops, maybe see if I can explain this. In my district, Detroit Lakes, where I taught prior to going to work for Education Minnesota, it came to our attention that the service co-ops had been giving the school district rebates, back it's called, on because there was enough money in the reserve accounts that there was a surplus. And so they were giving it back. We contended that that money was excess premiums and it should be shared by all, and the districts had not been, traditionally had not been sharing that. It was just serendipitously that we found that out. The first rebate that the Detroit Lakes got was about $70,000+. And the last one was about $170,000. And we had to, through contentious means, sort through that, and they finally came to agreement that, yes, in fact, that was premium dollars that should be shared by those who paid the premiums, both the school district and the teachers. So that there is that piece in there. I think, if I may, Madam Chair, I think the other part to look at on this is that sometimes it's just easier to stay with what you have, and the stress of being an administrator and a school board member sometimes is, you know, there's a lot of things they have to take care of. And so, you know, it's a lot of business. And so sometimes if they can say, well, we'll just let it ride here, it's better. I think in my testimony prior, what I was frustrated with is that when I would go to them and ask them, please listen to this, it's an alternative. Their inability to listen to me is what frustrated me.
Representative Beard.
Madam Chair, Mr. Granger. I think it's probably because of the nature of who you work for. You are a union. At the end of the day, you're a union. You necessarily have to have an adversarial relationship with the people that you're, whoever it is you're purporting to defend your members from. In this case, it happens to be the taxpayers. The school board members, the administration that works for the school board, I believe, have a fiduciary relationship to the people who actually are paying those premiums and the surpluses that the service bureaus may or may not be rebating back to the school district. Those people are called taxpayers. They're the ones that ultimately pay it. So if somehow a service co-op ends up with the surplus, which I think is the nature of the beast, it's the way we created it in the first place, I'm having a difficult time understanding how that's a conflict of interest, which is a very serious charge to level against elected officials or key employees of the 350-some school districts in the state. That's a serious charge. That's why I'm looking for it here. But those people are doing their fiduciary relationship not to a union, which is in an adversarial position, and I could also understand why they might be a little reluctant to just welcome you in whenever you have to share whether or not they save money on copiers or snow blowers or lawn service or whatever the host of things that the service co-op actually covers, in addition, oh, by the way, to these premiums that are paid for a health care plan. Now, I think it's admirable whenever local unions, and in Scott County, our unions get along famously with our management. That's been a deliberate plan over the years where they actually go out for coffee and donuts and go to each other's weddings and wakes and stuff like that. That is a marvelous thing. I wish every county in the state had the same kind of relationship that our school districts and our county employees have with our management and our school boards. Apparently not so in the district you just referenced. I'm sorry. But that can be worked on other ways, and one of the ways, I think, is to have the school board actually actively involved in shopping for something that might be a better premium. But your last comment is the one I want to zero in on before I'm done talking here. And that is that it is possible, and I think you just admitted, it is possible that the people actually running the service co-ops and the school districts are seeing a bigger picture than you and your members are seeing in the things that pertain to you. And that's okay. That's the way it is. That's why we hire people to actually manage the big picture, because we pay them to worry about things that I don't necessarily want my first grade teachers worrying about. Thank you.
Okay. I don't know that you're looking for a response on that, Representative.
I'm not necessarily looking for a response. I just want to know that aspersions of conflict of interest and people who are not looking out for their best interests of the people they're sworn to uphold is a very serious charge, and I don't take it lightly.
I would agree with that. That was disconcerting to me, too. We'll move on to the next question. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Elsweiger, you mentioned $33K for family and $28K for family. On those plans that you used as reference, how much is being paid by the school district? What are the dollar amounts?
Ms. Elsweiger?
Madam Chair and Representative Quam, those are figures that I actually heard in testimony from representatives of PEEP in the other body yesterday, and I did confirm them with a staff person today. I would guess that in those situations, they went into PEEP so they didn't have to pay the $38,000. Generally, and Mr. Granger might be better at answering this question, generally the amount that a school board contributes is, you know, not that significant. It can vary from district to district. When you see premiums like $18,000, which our members do see, the members pay a significant portion of that. So I can't answer your question specifically because I don't know what the average contribution is, and I don't know in those two particular cases. My guess is that it wasn't anything close to that dollar amount.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My experience from being on the school board is that at least the single coverage amount was paid in full, and then a portion of the family, and for the $28,440 annual premium, the single is $11,136, and the districts I was familiar with being on the Zed governing board, which were seven districts, it was quite common that at least half of the family excess of the individual was covered. In some instances, there were boards that or schools that paid all of the family, but I think that is ancient history since the increases. What I'm getting at here is the school districts have a substantial amount of money per person involved. They're contributing, I would say at least 10 to 15,000 in these examples. And so I think with that amount, when you multiply it times the staff, that's a significant portion of the budget. And when I negotiated contracts, health care was a huge portion of the dollars going to the contract. And because it's so significant, I would think it would just be reasonable to assume that 20% of your budget requires you to be participant in decision making on that large portion. Thank you.
Okay, we have a couple more questions, and then I think we're going to go on to Mr. Delmonico and Mr. Rice. But we do have a couple member questions. So Representative Winkler, and before that, we also have two more bills on the agenda. So hopefully we can get to those as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe I'll use the expression misalignment of interest instead of conflict of interest, and to see if there is some useful information here. Because I just want to make sure I understand what you're saying. If you have employees required to participate in a service cooperative health insurance pool, then both the employee and the district are paying into the larger cooperative pool. And is it your testimony that the cooperative then pays money back out of that pool to the district a rebate, I mean, which is kind of in the nature of cooperatives. They pay back a rebate, or they provide them funds for, I think you mentioned the spelling bee of the Knowledge Bowl. So you have both the employer and the employee ultimately paying into the cooperative, but only the employer determines whether the cooperative has to be the health insurance vendor, and then the employer gets some money back from the cooperative in some form, a rebate or other kinds of financial sharing. Is that the arrangement that you're describing?
Ms. Alschweiger.
Madam Chair, Representative Winkler and Mr. Granger can add some comments here. I don't think, I'm really hesitant to generalize that that's a common practice everywhere. I don't think that it is, but I think in some, we know that, we're aware that it has had happened in some situations, yes. And I believe as when the Detroit Lakes teachers found out what was happening and they had the discussion, then they were able to get some of that money back. But we are aware that it has happened. We were very concerned about it. We brought it up. And the resolution of some of those, I do not have that information to see where it all went.
Okay, then, Madam Chair, I would just make...
Representative Winkler.
Just the comment, then, that it seems to me reasonable that there would be concern, that you would have concern about an arrangement in which the employer determines which plan you have and then could potentially receive some benefit back by participating in the cooperative, because then they have an incentive to choose that vendor because they get some other benefit back. And if that benefit is not shared with the employee, then there is a misalignment of interest that could be cause for concern.
Representative Winkler, that didn't sound nearly as offensive, even though maybe it still was.
I'm trying to get Representative Beard to nod.
Okay. Representative Hornstein.
Well, thanks. I'll try to get Representative Beard to nod, too. No, I actually, Madam Chair, thank you. Just, it's more of a comment than a question. It is in reaction to Representative Beard's comment that he found union and management relationships inherently adversarial, but then there was a reference to Scott County where it wasn't. So I think just maybe the theme for this bill is that I don't think we can generalize about all of these situations. And so I have concerns about the bill, but I just wanted to just say for the record, I don't view union management relations as inherently adversarial. They don't have to be, and often they're not. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. At this time, I think I will take Mr. Delmonico and Mr. Rice up to testify, and then we'll get Representative Hoppe back at the table and take a few questions and vote.
Madam Chair, my name is Brian Rice with Rice, Michaels, and Walther. I'm here today on behalf of the Police Officers Federation of Minneapolis and the Minnesota Professional Firefighters. Lieutenant DeMonico is here, and I knew there was a reason for him to be here. He's a St. Anthony Village resident, but unfortunately the students have left already. If we could direct our attention to Section 2 of the bill, that's our primary concern. I'll have Mr. Delmonico talk, and I'll just make a quick closing statement on PEEP, since that's some legislation I actually was involved in drafting 25 years ago. Section 2 is in here, as Mr. Carlson testified, at the urging of the counties and cities. And he testified, I'm looking at page 3, lines 3.7 to 3.13, and this is also legislation that I worked on a number of years ago, and he used the term implicit rate subsidy, and he's right about that. There's a policy that this state has had for a long time, particularly as it applies to public safety employees, that when they have a normal retirement age that's 55, for public safety officers, these group of people are generally not covered by Social Security. They're not covered by Social Security through their employment, but we expect police officers and firefighters to retire somewhat earlier, and in fact, they do. The question then is, when you retire, can you afford health insurance? And I think we all know the big 800-pound gorilla in this room is health insurance premiums and what they've done all the way along the way. Excuse me, not Delmonico. Although he's getting up there. But the question is the cost of that grows, and this was a problem 20 years ago when this got put into state policy, because if you say you've got this pension, you're a police officer and you can retire, but you're looking at health care premiums that are going to be a huge disincentive to do it, you simply can't. And this was one way to bridge that by allowing employees to stay in the employee group, to be rated with the active members, and in the case of Minneapolis, and I would say most cities that we work with and firefighters, the employee pays the whole rate. There's no employer contribution. It's just that the premium rate would be set intergenerationally by treating these people and keeping them in the active group. And is there a rate subsidy? Yeah, there absolutely is. I got a call from my son who's in college, and I have a big rate subsidy to him, too, in the hopes that when he's my age, maybe he'll subsidize me at some point down the road. That's just called being a society, I think. And for police officers and firefighters, if you tell Mr. Delmonico, and I are both 53 years old, he can go in 2 years, if you tell him that, good luck, go out and get rated with other 55, 56, 64-year-old males, good luck trying to find a health insurance premium anywhere by anyone that's going to allow him to retire and not eat up every dime that he gets in a pension cost until he can get to 65 or older, when the federal programs would kick in. So our testimony on this is that this provision, if it's enacted, would do extreme violence to the pension retirement system that you have for public safety officers in the state, and I might add members of the committee as well as others. You know, this issue has been looked at, and normally your state employee average retirement age is creeping up to about age 65, just because of it. It's an older workforce. They tend to work to close to 65. It's also true with your PRA general employees that they'll be up there. School districts may be a little bit younger because they tend to have a little bit earlier retirement age, but not so much. It's still much greater than the police and fire average, and that amount is small. But especially as you're looking forward to Representative Downey has a bill, the 15 by 15 bill, that talks about shrinking the state workforce through retirements, attrition, not filling vacancies. Repeal this provision, members of the committee, and we have had some good conversations with Representative Hoppe, and he's going to work with us on this. I think it's going to take a lot of thought to figure this out, but if you were just going to say today, do what the cities and counties had, I would submit it's going to cause them more problems, because workers are going to want to have to stay longer. They can't literally afford to retire. They can't find that bridge to retirement. And I would say, you know, as far as the implicit rate study, there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, we do that all the time, and really in terms of public employees, it's the one way that allows them to keep that. So I'll conclude my remarks, and Lieutenant Delmonico wanted a couple of remarks. And if I could just make a quick comment about the overall bill, not in favor or against, it's more just information about how PEEP works and why it was set up.
I've been on Minneapolis Police, Madam Chair, Lieutenant John Delmonico, Minneapolis Police Federation. I've been with Minneapolis for 23 years. I've been on the Federation Board for 20 years, and I did ask the question, because the retirees were in part of the group, of, you know, where does that come into a subsidy? Where does that come into making our rates higher? And I was told that, you know, the reason for that is that collectively as a group, the young guys and gals help bring down the older guys and gals' costs. So, yes, for 23 years, I have helped subsidize the retirees, as has the cities, aware of what they've paid, and hopefully I will live to be able to have the younger cops subsidize my retirement and be able to get health care at someone a little bit more reasonable than if I didn't have the opportunity to do that. So, again, as Brian said, we would like to have public safety out of this. And Madam Chair and Representative Beard, I also agree that management and union should have good working relationships, and I'd go out for donuts with you. Because cops love donuts.
So do I.
Madam Chair, if I could, I just had a quick handout on the other part of the bill. It's more information to the committee, because I think that Representative Hoppe, obviously there's some strong feelings on this about PEEP and other things. If I could just give a by quick way of background, this is a list of entities that are now currently in PEEP. There's about 60. About a third of those are school districts. They tend to be very small communities all around the state. They're small cities. They're not the big institutions. It tends to be a group of people that and entities that have difficult time getting insurance. I worked on this legislation, I believe it was 1987. It was started in the House, and the law has pretty much sat on the books for a long, long time without a lot of issues. I think it's been a tool to help cover a number of public employees around the state, to provide competition, to get health insurance out there to members. Clearly, in the last few years, there's been this big dispute between Education Minnesota and the school board associations, which you saw earlier today. I think both sides make some points on this. Trying to sort this out is important. My plea to this committee, and actually it was John DeMonico, as one of his predecessors, a fellow named Dick Nelson, who came up with this idea. Dick was one of the first presidents of the Police Officers Federation of Minneapolis. He headed up the Minnesota Police Pension Council. He actually was on the board of PEEP for a number of years. Dick's still alive. He's my father's age. They graduated in high school about the same time, both World War II veterans. Dick really did a lot of good things. One of the things he did was this PEEP program as a way to dealing with health care costs. Literally, the same arguments were made. Health care is killing us 20 years ago. It was set up. I guess my plea to the committee is that this program has a lot of merit, and I hope in the process of a number of changes, it just doesn't get kind of blown up over this other dispute, because it has helped a lot of communities around the state, and it does do some good things.
Okay, thank you. Representative Nelson had a question, then I think I'd like to get Representative Hoppe back to the table.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess, and maybe this also should go be in commerce, because they're talking about insurance and subsidies and pool. And that's and what they're talking about with insurance is my understanding of it, and I'm not an insurance person, but my understanding of why you want to get a bigger pool is so that you can spread the cost over everybody, so in effect everybody's subsidizing everybody else that's in that pool. And that's part of the problem with these small communities. When you've got a small pool and you have one or two people that have high costs, that drives the cost of the insurance to be unaffordable. I don't think the subsidy for people that are 55 or retired is any different than the gentleman I know who had a sick baby, was born, had to have heart surgery, and he ended up with a $400,000 bill to my insurance fund. I was fortunate, and I'll knock on wood when I say that my three kids have all been very healthy, and I have not used my health insurance much because I've had healthy kids, I've been reasonably healthy, my wife's been reasonably healthy, so I basically have been paying in insurance all these years. I mean, what we're talking about here is, do we all go to individual plans and you pay the cost of what your insurance is and nobody else pays that? And so if Representative Beard, who may have diabetes and a bunch of other health problems, he's going to pay, not be able to afford to have insurance. And maybe if I'm healthy, I'm going to pay insurance and I can pay practically nothing because there's not going to be no cost out there. And that defeats the whole purpose of insurance and the subsidy and the pooling of it. What we do is to spread those costs so that it's affordable so everybody can have coverage. So I guess I don't like, I'm opposed to this bill, and especially this part here about the Section 2 that was just described here. I think this needs to have a lot of work done on this, because I had a lot of work done on this, because I don't think this is the way we want to go.
Thank you. And I will, I know several members came in late. Representative Hoppe did point out that he was aware that there did need to be some work. I still would like to move it on to Commerce and let Representative Hoppe and the interested parties continue to work on it. At this time, I think I'd like to get Representative Hoppe for closing remarks and then any additional questions we have. And I still would like to move on to the two bills because of our tight deadline. Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And it has been, I think, a very good discussion. And my plan and idea is to send this to Commerce and have a bunch of meetings. We're going to meet with, or I'm going to meet with Ms. Alschweiger and Ms. Kelleher and a bunch of people between then and now. And I think, you know, very good discussion. Clearly there's some work that needs to be done, and we'll take care of those things and then get it in Commerce and have another nice long discussion about it. So thank you for your time, members, and thanks for the good discussion.
Anybody have any wrap-up questions? Okay. Seeing no further discussion, Representative Beard renews his motion that House File 371 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to Commerce. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, nay.
No.
No. The motion does prevail. Thank you, Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Next on the list, we have House File 66. Drazkowski with what I trust is a non-controversial bill.
As long as it's not heard.
Welcome to the committee, Representative Drazkowski. Does this need to go to taxes next?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And as a matter of fact, Madam Chair and members, it was at taxes already.
At taxes.
And they wanted to provide you folks a chance to listen to this as there is an election component.
So to the floor then? Okay.
Yeah, I believe it would go to the floor. I'd even opt for the consent calendar, Madam Chair.
Well,
that's what I was told.
Representative Winkler says he was told it has to go back to taxes. Have you heard anything to that?
I have not, Madam Chair. I've heard nothing in that regard.
Okay. Well, at this time, I will move to the general register because I haven't heard anything about taxes, and since it's already been there, I would trust that they've done their work. So I will move Representative Drazkowski that House File 66 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the general register. To your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members, House File 66 is a pretty simple bill in its design. It's simply a repeal of the political contribution refund program. The first three sections of the bill are simply correcting references in statute that refer to it, and really the meat of the bill is Section 4, which is the repealer. The repeals, as attached to the bill, three different subdivisions located in three different sections. The heart of that, which is the subdivision 23 and 290.06, which outlines and provides the authority for the political contribution refund program. Members, you should have gotten a fiscal note for this. It would save the state about $12 million per biennium. And this particular provision has been included. I know I've offered in the past as amendments on the floor. It's been included in House File 130 originally, and I'm sure it's probably located in other places too. Really not a lot more, members, other than this is about priorities. As we look at the budget situation we have ahead of us, as we begin to prioritize things and look at functions of government we need to hold as priority, including education, taking care of seniors and disabled folks, and taking care of roads and public safety. This is one, this particular provision is one that provides subsidies to political campaigns of candidates and political parties. I believe it's a very easy call, one that we need to repeal and make room for those priorities we have in government. Madam Chair and members, Mr. Goldsmith from the Campaign Finance Board is also here if members have questions, but there are two different spreadsheets that Mr. Goldsmith put together. If you've got particular questions about them, I would encourage you to ask him. But you can see that actually in terms of the party units, the Republican Party has by far used to a ratio of almost three times more than the Democrat parties have this particular program. And you will see that average individual contributions for non-incumbents significantly exceeds in the use of the program those of incumbents. So a little bit on the elections and political side if you were looking at that. But those are two spreadsheets, and I conclude my initial remarks, Madam Chair.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Drazkowski, I understand that this is not as high as many other priorities, and I'm someone who's never used it, even when it was on the books. So I think I have some credibility to talk about saving it, because it probably wouldn't affect me. But why not just do what we did last biennium, which is just simply not fund it if it's not a priority? Why get rid of the program entirely when we may see the need for it again? And when we're flush again, which we will be someday, I know we can't picture it now, we might just want this program. Why not just defund it if, as you say, there are higher priorities rather than just get rid of it altogether? Because that's what we did last time.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Simon, A priority in the next biennium, I think, should be the priority as we set priorities for government in future bienniums, too. We're the only state that I'm aware of that uses this political contribution refund approach. Additionally, we have the checkoff program on the tax form that provides subsidies to candidates as well. So, in a way, it's somewhat redundant. So I see this as a priority going not only into the next biennium, but from here on forward.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, as I'm sure you're aware, and the public may not be fully, there are really two forms of candidate subsidies. One is the contribution refund program, which your bill seeks to get rid of. The other, though, is the campaign subsidy that's funded in part, but not completely, with the checkoff on income tax forms. Why not go all the way, then? If you really think that this is not appropriate, why not get rid of the campaign subsidy as well, so that nobody in this room gets any state money for their campaigns? Would you be okay with, I'm not proposing one, nor will I in this committee, but would you be okay, theoretically, with an amendment that says we get rid of the subsidy as well?
Representative Draskowski, I think I know the answer to this one.
Madam Chair, Representative Simon, personally, I would be, yes. The question is whether it should go on this bill or not. I think it's another discussion. If I was going to offer, if you'd be willing to offer an amendment, I'd be receptive to it, but... it's another discussion. I haven't dug into that yet. I understand that it is a voluntary contribution on the tax form to those who do volunteer to go that way. There are some differences that way. This is directly from the general fund and doesn't have those voluntary components. So it's kind of a different type of animal, if you will.
Representative Simon.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm sure you can predict what I'm going to say next, which is that, I have a real concern about getting rid of these kinds of subsidies permanently. Forever. I think they've done a great job in Minnesota of bringing the cost of campaigns down. Obviously, Minnesota is able to do and has been able to do now for a few decades what you can't otherwise do constitutionally, which is limit candidate spending. Supreme Court said, as of the mid-1970s, you can't do that. That's not constitutional. But you can do it if you trade something for it. So Minnesota has had the wise policy, I think, of saying, look, you get this money, and in return, you agree to limit your spending. And that has brought down remarkably the cost of campaigning in Minnesota. Even if you take this subsidy, you're only allowed to spend, even if you add both years together in campaign spending, it's under $40,000. Now, there are exceptions with non-campaign disbursements, as we all know from our own campaigns. But basically, the cost of running a race for the Minnesota House is really low compared to other states. And I don't have any data in front of me, but I do have anecdotes. I have friends of mine that live in states like Virginia with comparably sized districts for their state house or its equivalent, and they are by orders of magnitude spend more than we do. I know that in Virginia it's not uncommon to have state house races cost in the six figures, $100,000, $120,000, and I'm worried that if we don't have a cap in place, if we aren't able to put a cap in place because we're giving a benefit in order to get that cap, that we're going to have unrestrained spending in Minnesota elections. And I don't think that's good for anyone. It's not good for any of us. We'll spend all our time raising money. It's not good for our constituents. I don't think it's good for public policy. But could you comment on that danger, that if we really have an unrestrained system and we're allowed to spend whatever we want, whenever we want, if every candidate's allowed to do that, that could be a bad thing? Is that something you worry about, or do you think it's worth the trade-off?
What? I'm going to have you answer that in just a second. I'm wondering, Representative Simon, if you happen to know what the record is for what a candidate spent on a house race in the state of Minnesota. I was just wondering if you happen to know. I'll have to look into that. Representative Draskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Simon, I don't know either what the answer to Madam Chair's question is. I haven't seen, as I've looked at the records, anything over 40 or 50,000, but I'm sure there probably has been. Representative Simon, and you may want to ask Mr. Goldsmith, but as I understand it, and I think as he testified in the Taxes Committee, that the campaign spending limits are still intact for those who accept the other subsidy that we talked about earlier as well. So much of that integrity to that system will still remain with the repeal of this bill, as I understand it.
Madam Chair.
Representative Simon.
And I understand that. Your bill, I don't want to mischaracterize, your bill would not get rid of the cap because we'd still have the subsidy system, we'd still have that deal going where candidates agree to limit their spending, and in exchange they get a check from the state. But since you're receptive, at least in theory, to getting rid of that as well, and I appreciate your consistency, I think you're being intellectually honest there, I just wonder if someone were to take the next step, if someone were to offer an amendment, I'm not going to here today, but if someone were and it was accepted and it went into law, if we got rid of all state subsidies for political campaigns or candidates and therefore lifted the cap, would that concern you? I know your bill doesn't do that, but since we might not have the opportunity to have this exchange in other contexts, I just want to know whether that would concern you, or do you think it is worth the trade-off that we shouldn't be having state money involved and that there may be downsides, but you're willing to go with that trade-off?
Representative Gaskowski?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Simon, I am consistent. I philosophically don't believe that it's the responsibility of government to fund political campaigns, but I also understand the political realities of removing both of those right now. This is one that I think stands alone.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Madam
Chair.
Did
you have an answer to my question, Representative Winkler?
Madam Chair, I am not a campaign finance historian. Representative Drazkowski, you're probably aware just over a year ago of a Supreme Court decision called Citizens United that allowed for corporations to spend money from their corporate treasury on campaigns as independent expenditures. And the foundation for that decision is the concept that spending money in an election is the same as free speech. And I wondered if you agreed with that notion that campaign spending is the same as is could be should be considered free speech.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Winkler, I do, and I believe that unions and Indian tribes, as they are able to express themselves in Minnesota just as well, exercise that speech freely, and I believe that's a constitutionally protected right. I don't believe, again, that government should be participating in providing subsidy to an individual's speech.
Representative
Winkler.
Madam Chair, thank you. But Representative Drazkowski, do you agree that it's a good thing for individual constituents in your district to participate, whether in your campaign or your opponent's campaign, to make contributions to campaigns and to exercise their free speech rights through contributions? Is that a good thing?
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And yes, Representative Winkler, I think it is. And as a matter of fact, in the 2 years that this particular provision has blinked off, we have seen the continued exercise of free speech, at least in my campaign, and I suspect every other person who got here, I don't think any of us are independently wealthy. As a matter of fact, there's a $5,000 limit or something like that. But so it does continue, and the reality is if and when we repeal this part of statute, it will continue.
Madam Chair.
Representative Winkler.
Representative Drazkowski. So do you think it's a good thing that constituents of yours who don't have any extra disposable income, say a senior citizen in a nursing home, or a single mother, or a young family trying to get going in their lives, they just don't have the extra money to contribute. Do you think it's a good thing that they can't exercise their free speech rights and participate in the election, but people who have more money and more disposable income can participate? Is that a good thing?
I assume you're talking about financial contributions and not participating, because certainly they could participate.
Madam Chair, I was to the point of free speech and participating.
Representative Drazkowski.
With money.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Winkler, I believe it is their right to exercise free speech, and there are other ways other than digging into their wallet and exercising speech that way that they can become involved. As a matter of fact, many of my constituents, and I suspect yours too, do get involved in campaigns in a variety of ways. And again, this in no way inhibits that to continue. And so I don't see that as an issue. I mean, government can do all kinds of things if we continue to build programs. We can fund political programs. We can buy people cars. We can buy them cell phones. But these are not things that we have seen as priorities in functions of government. Representative Winkler and members, I believe this is not a legitimate function of government, and that's why I'm bringing forward the repeal today.
Well,
Representative Winkler.
Madam Chair, Representative Drazkowski, you have said that that political contributions, political spending is free speech, and you think it's good for people to participate. And then you compared a cell phone to the ability to exercise a fundamental right of free speech. And what I asked you is it a good idea that your constituents, and let's just use a senior citizen woman on a fixed income trying to pay high property taxes, is unable to participate in the political contribution system and thereby exercising her right to free speech? Is it good that she can't do it, but other people who have more money can participate and exercise that free speech right? I didn't say through this program. I said, is it a good idea that she can't, but others can?
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Winkler, I appreciate your questions, but the reality is we live in a free country, and it's hopeful that everybody will be able to have the opportunity, as we are free, to at some point in their life be able to dig in their wallet and dig out $5 or $500 or $5,000 to exercise or amplify their speech, if you will. I would suggest that people always have the opportunity for free speech. We're not in any way inhibiting their speech. Money, I believe, just amplifies their particular speech, and as it is an extension of that speech. But we're a free country, and it's a wonderful thing that people have the freedom to have eventually the opportunity, if they are able to exercise that opportunity in the right way, to at some point maybe amplify their own speech as well.
Well, Madam Chair, just
Representative Winkler,
get to the final point here. What you just said was that because we have a free economy, it's hopeful that one day everybody will have an opportunity to make enough money to be able to exercise their fundamental rights. And I would submit that the ability to exercise your fundamental rights comes before your ability to make money in the private marketplace in order to be able to afford to do that. The broader point I'm making, Representative Drazkowski, is that you and others have consistently described the PCR program as a subsidy for politicians. And that is completely untrue. The PCR program is a subsidy for people to participate in the political system. The Supreme Court, and you agree with this, has said that money is speech. And therefore, in Minnesota, we have created a program that says that if money is speech and campaign donations are speech, then everybody, regardless of their means, should have the ability to participate in this program. And be able to participate and exercise their right to free speech. And what you're doing through this bill is not eliminating a political subsidy. What you're doing through this bill is eliminating the ability of certain of your constituents who don't have much money to participate and exercise their free speech rights, as you have agreed that this is. And I think it's way off base for the reasons Representative Simon was talking about. I disagree with you. I think it's worth $12 million. I think that's a pretty small price to pay for allowing everybody in the state to participate in the political process. But eliminating this is not hurting us, Representative Drazkowski. It's hurting your own constituents who don't have enough money to write a big check.
Well, I'll let Representative Drazkowski answer that, although the cost is $12 million in the general fund. I'm comparing it to other important priorities. I'm not quite sure I follow that. But I'll let Representative Drazkowski answer that question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, Representative Winkler, I don't know if you got my earlier point, and that was that everybody has a right to free speech. What this particular provision does is it leverages taxpayer money to allow people at taxpayers' expense to amplify that speech. Everybody in Minnesota has the opportunity for free speech in a political process. This in no way takes away their opportunity for free speech.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the line of questioning that Representative Winkler did was what I had. But I guess I just have one, maybe it's a rhetorical question, that which other of our constitutional rights that would Representative Drazkowski believe that if I have lots of money, I have a better right of that than somebody that doesn't have much money. And I guess that's more a rhetorical question than a question that needs to be answered.
Any questions from the audience? Comments? Okay, if you could proceed to the table and perhaps go through it rather quickly, that'd be great.
Okay. Madam Chair, my name is, members of the committee, my name is Mike Dean. I'm the Executive Director of Common Cause Minnesota. We're a government watchdog group. I did not testify in the taxes committee mainly because my points are more around the policy, and so I wanted to just take a few minutes to talk about why I'm opposed to House File 66. Mainly, this legislation will open the floodgates a little bit higher of all the special interest money that's in our political campaigns. Back in January of 2010, Common Cause predicted that the U.S. Supreme Court decision in Citizens United would open the floodgates of special interest contributions at both the national and the state level to our political campaigns, and that's exactly what we saw. You think that despite one of the worst recessions in this country, that we'd see less money flowing into our politics, and that was not the case. Almost $4 billion was spent on congressional campaigns at the federal level, and we had one of the most expensive races in state history for governor of almost $20 million. All this money is having a harmful impact on our democracy. When special interest groups spend so much money to get their favorite candidates elected, those candidates will have to listen to them if they win. And this means that we have a legislature more interested in what big money players think than what average Americans and Minnesotans need. We're in danger of having a government of, by, and for the special interests, and not one of, by, and for the people. And we have to ask the question, what are these special interests expecting in return for those political contributions? It's hard to believe that special interests would invest the kind of money that they have been investing without expecting something in return. And Minnesota has largely avoided the political corruption that exists in other states because of our strong campaign finance system, and partially because of the political contribution refund program that's before you today. If we get rid of that valuable program, Minnesota politics will more quickly mirror that of California, which experiences political gridlock and policy failures unlike any other state in the union. And I think that's a high cost to pay for this legislation. The political contribution refund program, in a small way, tries to fix the broken system that exists. The problem with our political system isn't so much that individual politicians are corrupt, it's that the system itself is corrupt. Sure, there are a few bad apples in the barrel, but the real problem is that the barrel is rotten completely. No matter how honest you are, when your ability to get elected depends on collecting millions of dollars in special interest money, there's no way you can really be objective. And having to spend so much time fundraising just discourages really good people from running. And I think that as you get rid of this program, you're going to see more and more people opting out of our campaign finance system. And so those spending limits are going to no longer exist. And that's the concern that we see with the system. Since its implementation in 1992, the PCR has played a crucial role in really limiting the influence of special interest money and ensuring that politicians statewide are being held accountable by their constituents. The Campaign Finance Institute has used Minnesota's campaign finance system as really a model across the country. In 2006, 47% of Minnesota political contributions were from individual donations of $150 or less. That's actually unheard of in almost every other state. And it's because of the political contribution refund program. Most other states have single-digit numbers in terms of low-dollar contributions. And unfortunately, we saw this go down then for the first year that the program did not exist in 2010. It used to be 47%. It went down to 40%. And I expect that we'll continue to see that number decrease over the years.
Could you, I'm sorry, we have another bill and we have 4 minutes left in committee, so if you could make your final points, that would be helpful.
Sure. I think the major concern is just, again, with the amount of contributions coming in, do we want to create a system, and money's in the system no matter what, do we want a system where that benefits large donors, encourages large donors, or do we want a system with small dollar contributions? And really, Minnesota has favored that small dollar contribution system, mainly because there's not an expectation of something in return when a individual gives a small dollar contribution. But when you see those large dollar contributions coming in, there is an expectation of something in return. And I really think that we need to consider promoting this program and actually expanding it. Elections really should be the will of the people, not wealthy interests. Spending to elect candidates that will best serve their narrow interests
and not those of the people. So thank you very much.
Okay, any questions from members? Okay. With that, I will renew the motion that House File 66 be recommended to pass and be placed in the General Register. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, nay.
No.
Motion does prevail.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
We will at least attempt to start House File 917.
Madam Chair, while they're coming to the table, I'd like to move that House File 917 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Taxes.
Madam Chair, let's act on that. When the bill's in front of us, I have a question for the lead DFL member.
Okay.
On the other side.
Okay. Representative Winkler moves that House File 917 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to
Committee on Taxes.
The Committee on Taxes. And then we also there is an amendment, yes.
Representative Winkler, want to move the amendment also?
Madam Chair, I'll move the A1 and I assume somebody will speak to it.
Okay, I will move the A1 amendment. Did you want to intervene?
Just here? Briefly here. For process purpose, Representative Nelson, you and I came in 8 years ago together, and we know how freshmen are treated, or how freshmen are supposed to treat us when they have their first bill in front of the first committee. And I'm looking around, and I'm not seeing the love, love being spelled chocolate brownies or donuts. And I really would like to vote for this bill, Representative Nelson. Can you please maybe educate your newest member on how this works around here?
Representative Nelson, some education, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I was thinking about this earlier, whether this was Representative Moline's first bill or not, and whether she knows of the practice of providing treats to the committee upon presenting their first bill. But I was going to let it go by because of the lateness of the hour, but maybe we can remind her of this, and maybe at a future date we can have some treats provided to us by Representative Moline.
Yes, there was a reason that I wanted to get to Representative Moline first. I had a pretty good suspicion that this might be the bill hearing, but we're joking. We've got A1 has been moved. Did you want to talk about the amendment, or just briefly, and then we'll pass that, and then we'll go back to the bill?
Thanks, Madam Chair. It's really just a technical amendment to remove unnecessary language, so I would ask that it be included.
Okay. Any questions to the A1 amendment? All those in favor of the A1 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Amendment does prevail. To your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And Representative Beard, I thought that since we're here regarding county fairs, I probably should have brought some deep-fried food, but that was going to be difficult to do. But I will keep that in mind for next time. I think that my bill is uncontroversial. I hope so. What we're just trying to do with this is, and I think the reason we're in government operations is because it's allowing the county board to appropriate money to more than one fairground. And I, of course, represent part of St. Louis County, which is the largest county in the state. We're 6,800 square miles. We're actually the largest county east of the Mississippi River in the country. We're about the size of Connecticut and Delaware combined. So because of that, we have 4 county fairs so that everybody can participate in going to the fair over the summer. And right now, the way that the law is written, only one of those fairs is exempt from property tax. So that's really what this bill is in front of us to address. And I have with me the Government Relations Director for St. Louis County, who can provide more details, Mr. John Ungaro.
Welcome to the committee. If you could be relatively brief, that would be great. And if you could state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, John Ungaro, Government Relations Director for St. Louis County. The reason for this legislation, Madam Chair and members, is because we do have 4 county fairs. And 2 years ago, the legislature passed a law which required all pure public charities in the state to prove their tax-exempt status. As Representative Moline stated, one of our 4 fairs was able to get 501c3 status. The other 3 are basically real tiny fairs, and just to go through the paperwork, et cetera, to fulfill the 501c3 status would be quite onerous on them. But in addition to that, and what complicates the situation for St. Louis County is that unlike all the other county fairs in the state, none of our fairs are on county-owned property. So even if all of the other remaining fairs went out and got 501c3 status, the way the law reads from 2 years ago, they would not only need 501c3 status, but there's up to 6 additional criteria that they would have to meet.
Now, the Department of Revenue is very well aware of our unique situation in St. Louis County, and they have clearly stated to us that it was by no means their intention with this legislation 2 years ago to start taxing county fairs. And so they see this legislation that is before you today as the perfect remedy to resolve this dilemma. And so with the support of the committee, we would certainly appreciate your help in passing this so that we no longer have to have those little county fairs worry about suddenly having to pay property taxes when no other county fairs in the state have to pay property taxes.
Do we have any questions for Mr. Angaro or Representative Moline? Okay. Seeing none, Representative Winkler renews his motion that House File 917 as amended be recommended to pass and be re-referred to taxes. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion does prevail. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair.
Oh.
Just like to point out that that deep-fried donuts or mini donuts are deep-fried foods, so yeah.
I agree, and I just like to point out that I do like those. So, meeting adjourned.